Thank you, worship team. Good morning. Welcome to our service. Congratulations to my UVA friends. We've got a few alumni and a couple of parents of UVA students in the room, so congratulations. Good luck. It's tomorrow, right? Is it tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah, tomorrow night. Anyway, welcome. It's great to be worshiping together. We just finished last Sunday. We finished our hypothermia response ministry, and I want to say again, thanks to everyone who made that possible, who served in one way or another. We averaged about 62 sleeping overnight and had about 15 or so each night who didn't stay overnight but did come for dinner. They had somewhere else where they could stay, and so it was truly a blessing. We're still kind of tallying the number of volunteers that we had serve in this ministry, but it's incredible the number of volunteers and the number of volunteer hours, because so many of you served multiple shifts in multiple ways throughout the entire week. So I just want to thank you for that. And we have Brenda this morning who's going to come. She's with FACTS, so come on up, Brenda. She serves in development and communications with FACTS, and she just wanted to say a quick thank you to all of you this morning. Thanks for being here, Brenda.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'm here, again, representing FACTS, and I'm here to say thank you. You take on the most challenging week of hypothermia. You take the last week, and it can be a bit challenging as our guests worry a little bit about where they're going to sleep, and they may not have asked for housing yet, and they think they probably should do it soon. But I'm here to thank you for opening not just the doors of your church, but also opening your arms and your hearts and giving of your time and your talents to make sure that no one in Fairfax County stays out in the cold through the winter months. Hypothermia was started when two gentlemen actually froze to death in Fairfax County 15 years ago. It's just hard to believe in a county that's affluent and has so much as we do that could happen. And the program only exists today because of all of you. You open your doors, you feed people. Your food is legendary amongst the program, just so you know. Our case managers call it the Hypo 10. They all gain 10 pounds over the course of the season because they're so well fed all through the year, all through the season. But I also want to thank you for the most important part of what you do. When I talk with people who are homeless, they say there are many challenges to their life. The weather is a huge challenge. It's too cold, it's too hot, it's rainy, it's windy. Being hungry is also a challenge. Not knowing where your next meal might come from or whether you'll have enough to eat that day is a challenge. But what they say is the biggest challenge in being homeless is how you become invisible. You no longer have people who look you in the eye as they pass you on the street. They might actually cross the road so they don't have to talk to you. No one asks you how your day is, if you need anything. You literally stop being there until they come to your church for the week. You see them. You look them in the eye, and you say, "We're glad you're here. Welcome. Let me help you." You ask them if they'd like another slice of pie or another cup of coffee or if you can get them some cards to play or something to do to pass the time. You see them, and that raises their self-esteem. And that self-esteem means they may feel worthy of being housed finally. Every year we work with people, our case managers are there every night trying to build that connection of the heart that will make people feel they're worthy of being housed. Because often people will say no. They'll say, "No, I don't deserve it. Give the housing to someone else." But you make them feel worthy. When you see them, when you treat them like you're part of their family, you see them and it makes a huge difference. So on behalf of everyone at FACTS, on behalf of every life you touched during this time, I want to say a deep and heartfelt thank you for all you do. The program does not exist without places to house it and with loving hearts and hands like you all have. So thank you so very much. On April 25th, we're going to be hosting our 8th annual benefit breakfast at the Fairview Park Marriott. It's 15 years of hypothermia prevention this year, and we're going to be shining a big light on that at the breakfast. So if you find that you have time, you can go online to facetscares.org and register for the breakfast. There's no cost to attend, and I promise to have you uplifted and inspired by 9 a.m. So thank you all so much.
Thanks, Brenda. Let's go to God in prayer. God, we thank you for an opportunity to serve again this year, folks in our community that desperately need to be served and to be looked after. And so I just thank you for each person that participated in our church and just across the county through churches that served in this way. through other organizations that stepped in and provided support in some way or another. I thank you for Facets and for just the work that they do year in and year out. I thank you for the Lamb Center and the work that they do in this community, and just the incredible opportunity we have to partner alongside of both of them to help make this community a better place. And so I lift up all of our guests. I lift up all of those who are homeless that we didn't meet. I especially lift up the children in Fairfax County that are homeless, and just that you would watch over all of them and keep them safe and just provide all of the needs that they have. In Christ's name I pray, amen. So normally I would say at this point, grab your notes, but you don't have any notes because we had a printer failure this week in the office, and so you didn't get a bulletin on your way in. But if you do have the app downloaded on your phone or your iPad or your mobile device, then you do have the notes because they're all on there digitally, and you can take notes there. And so I invite you to do that. But we are in this series, and if you want to grab a connection card and take notes on that, feel free. We should have at least thought to put some paper out to you. For those of you who are note takers and writers could do that, but my apologies. But we're in this series that we've been in for a couple of months. It's one of the longest series that we've done, but it's a really incredible series, an important series, as we've just been following the story of Jesus. We were introduced to him on week one when he was 12 and visiting the temple, and we're following him all the way up to Easter Sunday morning, where ultimately he gives his life for the sins of this world. Next week, I'm going to be out of town traveling, visiting family in North Carolina. Lex is going to be here, our student pastor, and he's going to continue this series, and he is a wonderful speaker. So if you haven't heard Lex yet, you want to be here next week for that. And then the following Sunday is Easter Sunday. I hope you're planning to be here with us. I hope you're planning to invite some family and friends or neighbors that are maybe looking for a church home that would come with you this Easter. We'll finish the series up then. Today we're going to look at a part of the story of Jesus where Jesus does something that was so disruptive. He does something that I'm convinced was just so confusing that the disciples, there's no way they could fully understand what Jesus was doing and what Jesus was saying until after the resurrection. Jesus and his disciples, they were celebrating Passover in what, if you grew up in church, we called the upper room, right? Scripture refers to it as the upper room, this place that they were in. Judas has left to go and betray Jesus to the religious leaders, and it's just Jesus and his closest followers. And here's what we're told happened. While they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it, and he gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." And Luke's version says this is my body given for you. And I imagine as the disciples were getting ready to eat that bread, and Jesus said this, and they're about to take that bite, they paused and they said, "Wait a minute, what did he just say? Jesus, did you just say that this is your body?" But Jesus wasn't finished. It's about to get a little more offensive. He said this. He said, "Do this in remembrance of," to which they could have said to Jesus, "You don't have to tell us what to do this in remembrance of, because we know, because we've been doing this in remembrance of since we were little boys. Since we were kids with our families, with our moms and our dads and our siblings, we did this in remembrance of God coming to Egypt and taking his people out of Egypt and slavery and saving them. We know exactly what we're doing this in remembrance of, Jesus." And I imagine Jesus smiled and said, "Guys, that's all changing. Because from now on, when you celebrate Passover, you will now celebrate Passover. You will do this in remembrance of me." And now, Gentiles, let me talk to the Gentiles for a little bit, because we're all Gentiles, unless you're Jewish. And if you're Jewish, you're way ahead of me on this one. But Gentiles, let me just explain to you what's going on at this point. Everybody should have got up and left the room when Jesus said this. I mean, this should have been the end of it. The disciples should have stood up and said, "Okay, Jesus, so far you've contradicted Moses, and we were okay, you know, we could swallow that, and you've kind of set yourself up against Moses. And then there was that time where you compared yourself to the temple, and you said something bigger and better than the temple has come. But Jesus, you don't mess with Passover. You can't replace Passover, and you certainly can't make yourself the center of Passover, and you can't make Passover all about you." Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say that that this December, I mean, just imagine this December, I showed up and I said, okay, church, you know that normally in the month of December, we come and all month we celebrate the birth of Jesus, right? So this year, though, this December, all month, we're going to celebrate my birth, right? And we're going to come together each week and we're going to worship and we've got some new songs rewritten. They're all about me, right? And we're going to have this is all going to build and we're going to have a David Eve service and we're going to have some candlelights. You're going to invite all your family and friends. They're going to come to it. They're going to be super impressed. And then on Christmas Day, we're all going to come and we're going to put a big chair right here and I'm going to sit in it and everybody's going to stand up and just talk about how great I am. And November this year, it's going to be all about me, right? Here's my point. What Jesus did that night and what Jesus said to his disciples was way worse than that. It was so much more disruptive than that. But Jesus isn't finished. They eat the meal, and who knows what's going on through their minds as they eat this Passover meal, right? But here's what happens next. It says, in the same way, after the supper, he took the cup saying, this cup is, and again, they could have said, hang on, Jesus, because we know what this cup is. We know what this cup is. This cup represents the blood of animals that was shed on the night our ancestors left Egypt and headed to the promised land. This cup represents the animals that they had to slaughter. They had to slaughter a lamb, and they would take the blood of that lamb, and they would put it over the doorpost and down the sides of the doorpost, and the death angel passed over Egypt and the houses that had the blood of the lamb on it. The angel passed over those houses, and we all left under the blood of the lamb. We left Egypt and went to Mount Sinai, where God established us as a nation. So Jesus, we know all of this. So Jesus, could we please just stick to the 1,500-year-old script that we've all known since we were little kids, right? And I want you to understand how extraordinary disruptive this would have been for the disciples. There's no way they could have understood what Jesus was doing and what he was saying until after the resurrection. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup saying, this cup is the new covenant. Not a new covenant, the new covenant. This cup it's always represented the celebration of God's covenant with the nation. But Jesus was saying, from now on, when you take this cup, you are celebrating a brand new covenant, and it begins tonight, and it begins with me. And if they'd been paying attention when they were in Sunday school as little kids, these Jewish boys, they knew that the prophet Jeremiah had predicted that the day would come when God would establish a new covenant that would replace the current covenant. In fact, 650 years before Jesus said this, the prophet Jeremiah said, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt." That the covenant that God is establishing with Moses, where Moses came down from the mountain, he had all the rules and all the rituals, and he said, you know, it's not going to be like that. This new covenant, it's going to be a replacement covenant. So what kind of covenant would it be? Well, Jeremiah, 650 years earlier, he answered that question when he said, I will put my, here's the difference between the two covenants, I will put my law, the law that was written down on stones, the law that Moses gave you in the wilderness. He said, in this new covenant, there's going to be a new law, and I will put it in their minds, and I will put it on their hearts. They're not going to have to memorize the law of this new covenant. It's going to be a covenant of conscience. So back to Passover, he says, this cup is the new covenant. And the one that's been promised from a long, long time ago, the one that you guys, you should have been looking for, that's the one that's beginning now, Jesus says. And this new covenant, it represents a new kind of relationship, because that's what a covenant is, right? A covenant is an arrangement between, or it's an agreement between, two parties or two groups of people. And in this new covenant, it would represent a new kind of relationship, not between God and Israel, but between God and the world. Not between God and a group of people, but between God and individual peoples. Now, I want to pause for just a minute, and we'll come back to Jesus and the disciples, but I want to talk about ancient covenants for just a minute so that we can just all understand the significance of what happened in the upper room that night and what Jesus was saying. Because there were basically three different kinds of covenants that pretty much dominated the ancient world. And the first kind of covenant was what was called a bilateral parity treaty. A bilateral parity treatment. Now, there's not going to be a test, but you should pay attention, okay? So it's called a bilateral parity treaty, and this is a covenant between two equals, two equal groups, two equal peoples. It's kind of an I will, if you will covenant. And if you don't, then I don't have to. And if I don't do what you're expecting me to do, you don't have to do what I'm expecting you to do. Just think business transaction. Okay, that's the kind of covenant that this bilateral parity treaty would have been. It was an agreement between two equals. And then there was the bilateral suzerainty treaty. Now, a suzerain is like a king, right, or a leader or a really, really powerful person. And the way this would work would be the suzerain or the king would dictate the terms and the conditions to a lesser power, a vassal, who didn't really have much choice in the matter and certainly didn't have any input into the terms and the conditions. The best way to understand this type of treaty, this type of covenant, would be think curfew, right? Curfew. So it's like, son, it's my car. Right? Here are the keys to my car. I'm letting you drive my car. You are to be home by 10 o'clock with my car. What time are you supposed to be home? Say it out loud. 10 o'clock, right? And if you're not home by 10 o'clock with my car, then you don't get to drive it next time. And every 10 minutes you're late, I'm adding 20 minutes. And it just goes kind of on and on from there, right? And so the vassal, who is the child, is like, thank you, Father. Thank you for letting me use your car. And I'll try to follow the rules. And I don't get to dictate rules to you because you're the suzerain, right? And I'm the vassal. So that's how this bilateral suzerainty treaty work. Now, here's the most important thing about that. God's relationship with the nation of Israel, when he established them as a nation in the desert, when he came out of Egypt, it was a bilateral suzerainty treaty. It was like curfew, okay? God said to the nation, here are the rules, and God dictated all of the terms of the agreement. God gave them the rules, he gave them the regulations, and he gave them the kind of the punishments and the consequences that went along with them. If you would like to read them, they are outlined at the end of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and most of Deuteronomy, okay? They are the parts of the Bible that will put you to sleep. Now, they're really important, but they're not for us because we're not part of ancient Israel. And when you read them, you just have to ask the question, who could do all of this? I mean, they are just so, so complex and so complicated. But the reason they're there and the reason they are so important is because God was founding a nation. And all the Israelites knew up to that point was what it was like to live as slaves, because they'd lived in Egypt as slaves for over 400 years. So all they knew were slave rules and guidelines for slaves to live by. So God was having to give them everything they needed because he was starting a brand new nation and a brand new civilization. So he established an I will if you will covenant, but if you don't, I won't. And here's how it went. He said, okay, keep my rules, right? Obey my commands, and I'll keep you safe. And I'll make sure your crops grow, and I'll make sure you're prosperous, and I'll make sure you're protected from other nations, and you'll be victorious in war and all that. But if you don't obey me, if you don't keep my rules, then I'm not going to do any of that. And as you read through the Old Testament, you read the history of the nation of Israel, you see time and time again, it's just a back and forth of faithful to God, unfaithful to God, faithful to God, unfaithful to God. And that's how their history went. And at one point, and parents, you should really appreciate this, at one point, God put the whole nation of Israel in timeout. I mean, I guess that's where timeout came from. I don't know. But they abandoned God. They worshiped idols. And God comes along. He says, look, I've warned you. I've warned you. You broke your end of the agreement. So he took all of the leaders and he exiled them to Babylon for a 70-year timeout. And then once they kind of learned their lesson, he allowed them to go back into the land. So this was the kind of covenant that God established when he established the nation of Israel. Now, there was a third kind of a covenant that was common in ancient times, and it was called a promissory covenant. It was also sometimes called a patron covenant. And in this particular covenant, and this is really important, one party, just one party, binds itself to an obligation that's for the benefit of the other party. So one party binds itself in an obligation that's solely for the benefit of the other party. It's not bilateral. It's not if you do, I will, and if you don't, I won't. It wasn't that at all. It was unilateral, and it was unconditional. And the best way to think of this is to think middle school crush, okay? Middle school crush, because you either wrote the note, got the note, or your friend got the note and let you read the note, right? And the note went something like this: I promise to love you forever. I'll be your friend forever, even though you and your family are moving to San Antonio, right? And it was just, I promise. And it was unconditional. It was one-sided. And I don't expect you to write me, but I'll write you and all of that. So it was just unconditional, unwavering love, right? And I don't expect anything from you. Now, fortunately, if you were in middle school and you had a middle school crush, fortunately, you didn't ratify that covenant by taking one of your neighbor's cats and slicing it down the middle and sacrificing it, right? And I know that's really gross, but it kind of brings me to another really important part about ancient covenants. In ancient covenants, they were almost always ratified in the same way. Something had to die. Okay, and what they would generally do, and again, this is a little gross, but they would generally do is they would take an animal, and depending on how wealthy you were, the type of animal and how many animals they would use, but they would take an animal and they would literally split it down the middle and cut it into two halves, and they would lay it down on the ground, and there would be space in between them, and then each party that was making the covenant together would walk through the halves of those two animals. In fact, When we talk about cutting deals, that's where that phrase comes from, was this idea. It's what the Hebrew word means. It means to cut a covenant. It means we're going to cut a covenant. And so they would walk through these dead animals, and as they were doing this, what they were essentially saying to each other was they were saying, may it be unto me as it is unto this most unfortunate animal if I violate the terms of this covenant. To which some of us go, wow, that's pretty serious. And it was. Because in other words, I've pledged my life to you in this. I realize that if I violate this covenant, that it is a blood covenant between two parties. Now, this is important to understand for where we're about to go and where Jesus was going with the disciples in the upper room. In a promissory covenant, only one person is making the promise, right? So when a person made a promissory covenant, they would slice the animals open, they would have them up, they would lay them down on the ground and all that. But instead of both parties walking through, only one party would walk through. Why? Because only one party in the covenant is making a promise. In other words, it's all on them. And now, here's something that's so amazing. When God appeared to Abraham way back when, and God made Abraham that promise, and God said, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a family, and I'm going to make your family ultimately into a great nation, and then I'm going to use that great nation to bless the entire world. Abraham and God ratified that covenant with the sacrifices of animals. In fact, you can go back to Genesis chapter 15 and read about it. But they cut open several animals, they halved them up, they laid them out end to end, there was space in between them, and Abraham did not pass between the pieces. This was all on God. So back to the night in the upper room at Passover, God's establishing a new covenant between God and the entire world that we would ultimately find out. So the question is, what kind of covenant was Jesus talking about? And Jesus answers that in the way that he explains the new covenant. Here's what he said. He said, this covenant, this cup is the new covenant. And then the next statement clarifies what kind of a covenant it's going to be. This cup is the new covenant in my blood. I will play the role, Jesus said. I will play the role of the animal that is sacrificed to symbolize and to launch this new covenant, to which disciples could have asked, okay, if that's your part, Jesus, then what is our part? This cup is a new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. Guys, Jesus would say, and eventually the whole world, he would say, you are on the receiving end. And I, as God's representative who has come to establish this covenant, I'm on the giving end. Or to say it another way, this is all for you, but it's all on me. This is 100% for you, but it's 100% on me. Matthew's account, if you read that, it adds a couple of words. He says, this cup is a new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you for the forgiveness of sins. And you know, really the disciples, they should have seen this coming. Because on day one, in fact, we looked at this in week two of this series, when Jesus stepped onto the pages of history as an adult, John the Baptist, looking to this moment, maybe three years or so earlier, he said to the crowds there that was gathered down in the Jordan River basin, he said, look, the Lamb of God, who all by himself, all on him, takes away the sin of the world. And the next day, this new covenant that Jesus introduced to his disciples, the next day, this new covenant in his blood for forgiveness of your sin and for the forgiveness of my sin, it would be officially ratified by Roman nails and on a Roman cross. The new covenant, the new arrangement, the new agreement between God and the entire world, a new covenant for every nation and every generation to come. This was the final one. This was the everlasting one. This was the one that would fulfill God's promise to Abraham and replace God's arrangement that he had with the nation of Israel. It was an unconditional covenant. It was a promissory covenant. Only on half of the relationship, only one party would bear the burden of this covenant, and it would be Jesus, God's Son. And here's the interesting thing. The way that you and I get into that covenant, it's so simple. It's what we talked about a couple of weeks ago where we looked at the gospel writer of John where he said simply, whoever believes in, whoever trusts in, receives. Whoever believes in, not believes that, it's not about facts. Whoever believes in, whoever trusts in Jesus receives. They're on the receiving end of what Jesus has done. And in Jesus' invitation today, it's the same as it's always been. And it's simply, follow me. Follow me. So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to celebrate this new covenant in the same way that Jesus introduced it. We call it the Lord's Supper. And it's an incredible symbol that he gave to us to remind us of what he was about to do. And if you've said yes to Jesus, if at some point in your life you said, I believe in, as much as I understand, I believe in, then this is for you. He established this for you. And if you're here this morning and you've never said yes to Jesus, then I want to invite you to what he invites you to, and it's simply to follow him. To follow him. And you don't have to have it all figured out. And you don't have to have a bunch of verses in the Bible memorized, and you don't have to have been baptized or be a member of this church or any church or any of that. You just have to believe in. And the promise of God is you will receive. You'll be on the receiving end. So we're gonna stand. Our team is going to come and lead us in our song of response. And we're going to stand and sing. And as we stand and sing this song of response, I just want to invite you to begin to prepare your heart, however you need to, as we get ready to take communion this morning together. Let's stand and sing.